Hi, this is Bill Hines, and I'm your instructor for the course Practicum in Biblical Counseling for the IABC track in Biblical Counseling at Master's Divinity School. The title of this tape is The Counselor and the Law. And please let me begin by making it very clear that I am not an attorney. I have not been trained as an attorney, and I am not an attorney. So much of what I am sharing with you, or all of what I am sharing with you, is from a perspective of one who has read up on these things, and I have taught this course in various places several times. And I have read some of the books, one in particular that I'll be referring you to. So think of this as my exhortation to you to look into the laws of your state as you set out to perform biblical counseling wherever you are, that you'll be prepared to know what to expect if anything were to come up of a legal nature, and so that you can comply with those laws and have the best witness that you can possibly have as a Christian. A good friend of mine was counseling as a biblical counselor in a particular state, and she was confronted with a child molester. This was a father who had abused his daughter sexually, and she said, "I am bound by the laws of this state, and you knew coming in here that I would be, and so either I'm going to call Child Protective Services or you are, and you're going to turn yourself in." And she said, "I suggest that you turn yourself in rather than have me do it. It will go much better for you if you do so." After he cried a bit, he picked up the phone. She gave him the number, and he called in her presence and turned himself in. She did some great work with that family. She got to know the daughter, who was a teenager by this time, got to know the wife, the other kids in the family. She attended the various legal proceedings, and it reminds me much like Daniel. You may remember that Daniel won favor with the Babylonian guard because he came across as one who was respectful and one who was committed to his God and to his beliefs. And my friend must have come across the same way with that court, because when the prosecutor and the Child Protective Services people were there, and the court was filled with people who knew what they wanted to have done, after having heard all the testimony and after having heard many people testify over the months concerning this case, the judge looked at the prosecution, and the question had been raised, "When can he go home?" And as the judge looked at the prosecution, he said, "He can go home when she," pointing at my biblical counselor friend, "when she says he can." Because of her professionalism, her knowledge, her skill at working these things out, at seeking to reconcile these people, she had impressed him, and he saw it. And in this case, we had a judge who was concerned about the people more than he was concerned about what was politically correct. Well, any of us can do those things if we will just approach things professionally, with integrity, and with real care for the people that we're trying to help. There's a book that I was assigned to read by Dr. Howard Eyrick when I took a course on counseling and the law from him. And the book is entitled Legal Issues and Religious Counseling. This book, Legal Issues and Religious Counseling, is by Ronald K. Bullis, B-U-L-L-I-S, and Cynthia S. Mazur, M-A-Z-U-R. It is a short book, and it is excellent. It is well worth getting and reading, and I encourage you to do so. what I'm going to do for you right now in a matter of about 5 or 10 minutes is to go through my own summaries of their chapters. This is in no way meant to be complete or to hit on all the relevant topics, but I will just go through this in a leisurely way to make you aware of the things that they find are important to the counseling process for clergy. Chapter 1, the First Amendment and Religious Counseling. It is pointed out here by the authors that religious counselors are vulnerable to be sued in three predominant areas. Number one, if the counselee commits suicide or hurts another person. Personal response, take no chances. I should invite the counselee to tell a member of the family to whom he or she is accountable or to the proper authorities in cases of child abuse or other acts of violence which are illegal. If they refuse, I will be compelled to break confidence and report them myself. Number two, if the counselor is accused of sexual misconduct or contact with the client. So that would be sexual misconduct or sexual contact with the client. As a personal response, I suggest that I will make every effort to maintain accountability with my wife, the churches I represent, the association I represent, in my case, IABC, as well as NANC or NANC, and the church denomination that has ordained me, and my board of directors. Any voiced concern on the part of a counselee will be reported to my board and my wife immediately, with the board having the responsibility for. The third area that the authors say that religious counselors are vulnerable to be sued in is for breach of confidence, either by divulging private information or by failing to divulge information as required by law if a third party were or might be harmed. Now, my personal response for both of those, in the first case, I will simply need to keep my mouth shut about those whom I counsel. And I have seen so many people hurt by this, counselees hurt and ministries hurt, and I'll tell you that just by my observation, the place that it breaks down the most is either a church worker or a pastor telling his wife, or a woman telling her husband, or bringing up as a prayer item within the church or within even a small group of people. We're just going to have to really think through this whole confidentiality thing and resist the temptation to gossip or to feel like we have some sort of power or mysterious knowledge about other people. There is a real sense of pride that kicks in here. We have to be real careful of it. Because I believe in many ways this sort of knowledge is sort of like the old Gnostics. We have this secret or esoteric knowledge, and we think somehow it gives us some sort of power. We're going to have to resist that temptation. My personal response to the second item there about failing to divulge information as required by law if a third party were or might be harmed is that I will invite the counselee to tell a member of the family to whom he or she is accountable or the proper authorities in cases of child abuse or other acts of violence which are illegal. If they refuse, I will be compelled to break confidence and report them myself. Again, you're going to have to really think through that and decide if you can break confidence in the case of legalities or illegal activity. One of the things that you need to decide is what you're going to do about that, and you need to let people know up front the kinds of things that would limit your confidentiality. Chapter 2 is tort law, and this chapter concerns clergy malpractice. The authors believe that for now, no court will take the issue because there have been so many attempts that have failed. What the authors do believe will happen is that ministers will be held to more basic torts of invasion of privacy, breach of fiduciary duty, or outrageous conduct. My personal counseling will reflect an approach which stays within the bounds of personal privacy, recognizing that I cannot confess for someone else, yet I can encourage them to confess that which needs to be confessed for their own healing and the good of others. And I might reference James 5, where James tells the people to confess their sins that they might be healed. In regards to my fiduciary duty, I will be certain to keep the good of the counselee in focus. As to the outrageous conduct, knowledge of normal practice in the present culture will help in that I will remain within the boundaries of what is acceptable in regards to touch or anything which could be considered flirtatious with the opposite sex. And as pertains to more religious practices, such as praying, it will be with the permission of the client. There are other religious practices, such as the laying on of hands, which would be only in the context of other Christians being present and at the request of the client. Here, accountability is key. And for some people, they do much prayer, even binding and loosing of spirits, etc. And regardless of what you believe about those things, you're going to have to think through what your responsibilities are and consider one thing that I think is very important, and that is, what does a client want? What are they used to, and what do they desire? Now, if they desire something that you don't believe is valid, then certainly you can't go there. But you could always refer them to someone else or let them find a different counselor if it's something very, very important to them. In chapter 3, they talk about the expanding vulnerability of religious counselors to legal action. And according to the authors, the types of conduct for which clergy have been sued have broadened in recent years. They discuss the sexual and the protection of third parties in some detail. For the most part, I will defer to what I wrote above concerning those various acts or that type of conduct. In regards to sexual misconduct, the counselor should understand him or herself well enough to know how they operate in regards to transference and simply not do it. Transference is a term being used by the courts. I suggest the following guidelines as red flags. And by the way, transference is that just what goes back and forth between people of the opposite sex. So, in terms of guidelines, I suggest the following. When you notice that the client is physically or emotionally attractive, that should be a red flag. When the client makes flirtatious remarks towards the counselor, another one. When the counselor finds him or herself looking forward to seeing a particular client. When the client raises issues or presents a pattern that is particularly captivating to the counselor. Sometimes I find myself just getting really interested in the story and wanting to hear more and more of the story, even when it has nothing to do with what we really need to be talking about. I remember a man came in one time and he just had a wild story just about some things he had been involved with, and I had to just keep reminding myself that I needed to go back to really helping the man with what he came in with, not just have my own desire for a good story met. Finally, another red flag, when the counselor's relationship with his or her spouse is going through a difficult time. Now, any of these things can be resolved in easy ways. If somebody is attractive, it doesn't have to mean that anybody acts in an inappropriate way. But again, I stress, know yourself. If before coming to Christ, you were flirtatious, you were promiscuous, you had a reputation with the opposite sex that was not good and was not something you would want to carry out as a Christian, then you may be a candidate for not counseling the opposite sex at all. Or certainly, I always encourage people when they do counsel the opposite sex to have other people around. Have a window in the door. Don't have a sofa in your counseling office. Those things can just send the wrong message. If you do have a sofa in the office, just make certain that you are never seated by the person. And again, I just find it better not to have one at all. Well, concluding this chapter 3 on the expanding vulnerability of religious counselors to legal action, when dealing with a child or spouse abuse, when dealing with child or spouse abuse, we must respect the law and the third party more than A, the desire to keep the client from legal trouble, and B, the desire to believe the pleas of the client concerning how this will ruin his or her life, or C, the desire to believe that the person has or will change. These are big, big things. When somebody is pleading with you, oh, please don't tell, please don't tell. It'll ruin my career. My marriage will be over. Everybody in the church will find out, and I can never go to church again. You know, when we're dealing with this, we need to keep in focus the person that has really been harmed, the child or the spouse. And we need to realize that if a person is disciplined by the courts, then this too falls under God's jurisdiction. And places like James 1 and certainly Hebrews 12 talk a lot about our discipline coming from the Lord. I also suggest that there should be an attorney or retainer for the client to call concerning any questions. I'm sorry, let me repeat that. You, as a counselor, should know of an attorney in your area that you have on retainer that you can call concerning any questions. So if somebody says, yeah, I slapped my kid, and you're not sure whether that falls under the abuse statute or not, you can call them and you can ask them and you can talk about it, and they can say yes or no or advise you. Chapter 4, State Regulations of Religious Counselors. In response to this chapter, I make the following observations. All counselors must have a clear and updated job description. 2, all counselors will be precise in their descriptions. What are you going to call yourself is another way to look at this. In our ministry, we call ourselves biblical counselors. We don't talk of ourselves as professional counselors or state licensed counselors, because we're not. We talk about ourselves as biblical counselors, sometimes certified with IABC also enters the description. But be very careful about what you call yourself. If they call you a professional counselor, sometimes it's best to say, I refer to myself as a biblical counselor. One time I had somebody that came to me, and somebody had told them, without my knowledge, that I was a licensed psychologist. And so when they, after they had met with me one time, they asked me to fill out some form for them about work. And I said, well, they won't accept this, and I told them why. And he was very, very gracious and realized that whoever had told him this was not somebody that was on my staff or anything, and that I had not misrepresented myself. But that can certainly happen, and we want to be real careful to represent ourselves only as what we are. Another point here under state regulations of religious counselors, we need to be certain to understand what our state sets as limits for religious counselors. Be real careful to understand what your state says. All counselors for our particular ministry will be certified by either the National Association of Nuthetic Counselors, or NANC, or IABC, which is the International Association of biblical counselors, or both, to assure that a larger body has recognized their qualifications and their ethics. This is something that came out of the Nally case that this book talks about later. This was a case of a suicide related to John MacArthur's church out, Grace Community Church out in Southern California some years ago, that really helps to understand that case, really helps us understand what we need to do to just safeguard ourselves and to help those that we're trying to help. Finally, job descriptions, including the type and amount of counseling to be done by the counselor, should be kept on file. Again, everything just in good order, very clear, good, clear job descriptions that anybody can see or hear if they ask. Chapter 5 is Privileged Communications for Religious Counselors. The authors state, quote, "When clergy breach confidences," stated the court, "they can be sued for unreasonable intrusion upon the privacy of another, or defamation, or both," end quote. We must maintain confidentiality. In response to this chapter, I noted that often those who try to get me to breach confidence are the spouses of those involved in divorce or child custody cases. My response has been to explain the confidentiality clause in our PDI, or personal data inventory, and to put the weight on them to obtain a release from the other party. This usually ends the pursuit. This clause reminds us that everything must be done in good order, releases must be obtained, and people must be informed as to our approach to confidentiality prior to beginning the counseling relationship. I had one man that tried to present himself as one who knew the law. This man was trying to present himself as one who knew the law and almost as an attorney. What he was a jailer at a local prison. And I knew that, and I'm not sure why he thought I wouldn't know that. And this was a child custody thing, and he was trying to get information that he shouldn't have. And I simply returned a note that said, "I'm sure if you understand the law that you know that I need a subpoena or a release by your wife to give you this information. And until that comes, I will not release any information." And I did not hear back from him after that. Sometimes it can be handled very simply. The main thing is don't get too excited when you get that note or something, some legal document. It's just a matter of understanding it and getting your attorney to help you understand it. Chapter 6, Laws Limiting the Clergy Privilege. Most of my personal reaction to this chapter has already been expressed. This chapter did, however, give the advice that I should retain an attorney to answer the question stated at the end of the chapter. They give a number of questions that we should ask ourselves, specifically in regards to whether my state is one of mandatory or permissive reporting in the case of child abuse. Some states require it, some states just simply suggest or encourage it. It is, however, clear to me that the client must know prior to engaging in counseling that certain behaviors or conditions will be reported to the proper people or authorities. They may choose not to meet with me because of that. And that is just how it is. I really encourage you to let people know ahead of time. Sometimes you may even have somebody come in that says something about her husband or he about his wife, knowing that you have to report. It may be their way of revenge, their way of getting back. You need to think through all those things, but you need not let those kinds of things stop you from doing what is right and doing what really helps the victims in our society. Chapter 7, General Trends and Patterns of Religious Counseling Liability. According to the authors, religious counselors are being sued because of issues related to confidentiality, content of advice, and sexual misconduct. Those are the same, essentially the same things we said earlier. They go on to conclude that, quote, the courts generally appear to be using a standard that measures the malice of the religious counselor and the harm rendered to the counselee, end quote. In responding to this, I'm reminded of the response God had to his people in Jeremiah 29:11, where he says, for I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope. See, my desire for my client must be for his or her best before God. If that is my guiding principle, I will not be found guilty of doing harm to my clients. Further, if I find my technique or advice to be out of the mainstream of my colleagues in the field, I should make proper inquiries and gain counsel as to my counsel before breaking too far from the norm. And then finally, in chapter 8, which is entitled A Legal Audit for Religious Counselors, the author stated that to determine whether a confidence should be breached, the counselor should determine, 1, who would be damaged if the minister remains silent, and 2, who will be damaged if the minister breaches the confidentiality. The following are insights I gained from the chapter. First, put child abuse in a special category. Second, determine the goal in breaking a confidence. 3, determine whether this is a civil or criminal matter. 4, keep records of conversations with clients and of any warnings or discussion of the client with family members, authorities, or other professionals. In other words, keep records of everything you do regarding this. Another point is there should be no romantic contact between the counselor and the client. I know I've said that before. Dr. Eirich has even suggested that if a single counselor were counseling another single person, and there was an attraction that came out of it, he suggests that once counseling has ended, that there should be at least a year lapse before that counselee was contacted on a social basis. Not a bad idea. That certainly would look good to everybody, would show, your basic heart's intent to be one of integrity. So really need to think through that. But certainly there should be no romantic contact between the counselor and the client. And again, know yourself and know what other people think when they see you. If they see somebody come in and a man gives this woman a big hug, does it raise any eyebrows? Does it hold any concern for anybody? Would it to you? Be very careful. And finally, maintain malpractice insurance. This is a big thing, and you'll have to decide what you want to do about it. But I find that most people these days are keeping and maintaining malpractice insurance. One other thing that I would suggest here in this chapter on a legal audit for religious counselors is that we maintain a relationship with a certifying body that requires adherence to a code of ethics by annual affirmation. In other words, every year you have to reaffirm this code of ethics and these standards by which you operate. That's what we try to do at IABC, is we have everybody that every year says that they do uphold these standards. NANC does the same thing. So that is the overview of the book by Bullis and Mazur, Legal Issues and Religious Counseling. Again, an excellent book that I have found well worth the reading. I found another book that was well worth reading. It's a book entitled Christian Counseling and the Law by Steve Levikoff. And from this, I constructed several questions that I, through my study of his book, came up with answers to, for these questions. And I would like to briefly run through these questions and answers. I think they will be instructive to you. The first is, does your letterhead, business card, or promotional literature identify you as a professional counselor? I am instructing our two counselors to review all information that goes out of our office to be certain it refers to us as biblical counselors certified by IABC. And I am doubling my efforts to make certain people know we do not work for the churches that give us space to meet but operate out of the church, as might a Boy Scout group or some other group. See, in our position, some churches give us space, but it is theirs loaning. The space given us by various churches is given us on a loaning basis only. Again, much like the Boy Scouts or some other nonprofit corporation might be able to use. Number two, does your literature identify you as having expertise in a particular field, for example, marriage or family counseling? Just present yourself as what you are. I often tell people that I am a sort of general practitioner, and I often refer clients to medical doctors for evaluation. We also are instructed to give no medical advice, but if we suspect a medical problem, we suggest they see the doctor and offer to call the doctor with our concerns. And this is, of course, with a proper release. In other words, I don't believe that it is proper for me to say, it sounds to me like you have a blood sugar problem, or it sounds to me like you need this or that medication. What I may say is, you know, this raises a question, and I often ask somebody, go to the doctor and ask them for a complete physical and tell them of these concerns, and I make sure they know which concerns I heard. I've had several people that have been greatly helped by just that, especially when they go to the doctor and they say, I'm hearing voices or I'm doing this or that, and they find out their thyroid is way out of balance or something else that's very measurable. Good science really helps us with our ministry of counseling. Number three, if you're promoting yourself as a professional, how do your educational credentials stack up with similar practitioners in your area? For example, do you have a few undergraduate counseling credits, or have you completed a comprehensive program such as an MA in counseling? This is an important delineation. If, for example, you have limited professional education and are called to testify in a court of law, the opposing side may bring in an expert witness who is able to discredit your testimony by means of a more extensive professional education. And again, say what you are and don't say anything else. All of our counselors are required to qualify for certification with either NANC or IABC. Now, the reason I say are required to qualify for certification is that both the counselors that I was talking about when I wrote this were trained in part by myself, and they got their supervised hours under me, so they were in the process of being certified by IABC, and that is what we require in our bylaws, that they are either in process of being certified or are in fact certified. Those groups require a certain number of graduate hours. I'm talking about NANC and IABC, and they require these hours from a recognized educational association and the sustaining of both theological and counseling exams. Now, this recognized educational association where they can get their training could be NANC training or IABC training or a number of things such as Master's Divinity School that we have set forth as programs that we approve. We are in no way promoting ourselves as equals with licensed psychologists, but as biblical counselors. We are not part of the psychological profession. And if you've heard any of my other tapes, you know I don't want to be. I do not believe that they have an adequate handle on the truth, and I don't believe they can speak to the soul of man. Now, I'm diplomatic in how I come across if I'm speaking to them. I'm clear, but I seek to be kind. And just to say that we are in two different worlds. We are dealing with a soul based on the authority of God's Word and the sufficiency of Scripture. They are basing their views on the views and the education and the observation of man. Two different worlds. So while we may actually possess the academic qualifications required by the state for licensure, we do not present our qualifications in that way. I have the academic required academic courses and degrees for licensure in the state of Texas. Now, there's some other hoops I'd have to jump through, sustaining exams, 4,000 hours of supervised, I think it's 4,000 now, supervised counseling. But I don't present myself in that way. I certainly tell them what my education is. I tell them why I chose to work as one who is ordained, as opposed to going through and getting my licensed professional counselor license through the state. Number four, if you're a pastor, are your counseling services available only to members of your congregation, or do you counsel non-members on a regular basis? Now, that's a good question. You just need to be clear in who you're going to see. We are clearly biblical, and those who are not Christians know from the beginning that we will be seeking their conversion. I see a number of different people from different congregations, and often the spouse of a person will come who is not a believer. I'm dealing with one of those right now, and we just take a little bit of time each time to talk about why it is that he is not ready to come to Christ. And it's a very interesting discussion. If we had more time here on the tape, could tell you some other great stories about just approaching it this way, them knowing that they are not any closer to heaven as a result of, say, communicating better with their wives, although it can bring more peace to the home and a better situation for the children, etc. Number five, if you're a pastor, is most of your counseling done on a one-time or occasional basis, or do congregants meet with you for a regularly scheduled weekly appointment? Now, that's another good question to be able to answer and to decide. One church in our area that has been very supportive of us told their pastor, you can see people two or three times, and if they need more after that, then send them to Bill. And that has worked out very well. Number six, if you meet with individual congregants on a regular basis, are the meetings called counseling sessions? If you are referring to the sessions by another name, are they legitimately something other than counseling sessions, per se? In other words, you want to call it what it is. If you're getting together with lunch, but it's really you're digging into this guy's life and you're doing counseling, you want to be clear with him and in your own mind that that is indeed what you're doing. Again, call yourself what you are. I know I keep saying that. Very important. A friend of mine who was sued told me over and over again, only call yourself what you are. I think in his case, he had allowed some people to refer to him in some term other than what he was, and it really came back to hurt him. Number seven, do you charge a fee for your counseling services? If so, is it a fixed hourly fee? Now, we do not charge a fee. Some people freely give to our ministry, but there is no fee expected or implied. If you do charge a fee, to whom do you charge it? How do they pay? Who gets that money? For instance, if there was a staff person on at a church and somebody from outside the church came and that person was charged $50 for a session, does the church get the money since the staff person is on staff and they're getting paid to be there anyway? Or what is the arrangement? It just needs to be very clearly and carefully spelled out so that everyone's integrity is intact. Number 8, if your church has a counseling ministry that uses lay counselors, does the church charge a fee to counselees for the services of lay counselors? If so, they may be acting as professional counselors. Again, that's really important. You want to be sure, what is a professional counselor considered in your state? And if you use lay counselors and they charge a fee, it may put them into a different category. So again, be careful to understand the laws. Number 9, if you are not a professional counselor, are you doing anything by way of omission that might give your clients the impression that you're a professional? For example, if a person calls you doctor and you do not have a doctorate degree, are you careful enough to correct him or her? And I know there's been times that I've slipped when people called me doctor back before I had my doctorate. And even now, when somebody calls me doctor, I explain somewhere in the beginning, I describe my doctorate. I say that I have a Doctor of Ministries degree from Trinity Bible College and Seminary in association with the University of Liverpool. That is where I got my degree, is a Doctor of Ministries. I sometimes go on to say this is a vocational doctorate. And just making it clear that I am not a psychologist, that is really important. And as in the example I used earlier, if the person that had sent that one man to me would have said he has a Doctor of Ministries, yes, he is Dr. Hines, and he works as a biblical counselor, that may have given the man a heads up. Number 10, is your counseling religious enough to the extent that you regularly use the Bible as a resource? If you're counseling a person with an emotional disturbance and neither referencing Scripture nor coming from a biblical framework, chances are you're engaging in secular, not Christian counseling. Actually, I would say you're definitely not coming at it from a biblical counseling perspective. We always refer to the Bible. We always have a Bible present there on the table in all sessions. That is what we're supposed to do. In other words, well, I'm the president of the company, but of the nonprofit corporation, which is our ministry, and I make sure that those who work under me have a Bible present and use it and know how to use it. This author, Levikoff, concludes this section by saying that a Christian counselor is not a counselor who happens to be a Christian, but one who, on the whole, operates from a biblical framework in counseling practice. Now, I would like to make just a few other comments that may seem a little disconnected, but just as I'm going through my notes concerning the counselor and the law. First of all, let me mention that we want to beware of warranties. You know, when somebody's hurting, it's awfully easy to want to respond to them and say, you know, I will be with you and I will walk you through this every step of the way, and then have them expect something that we can't really deliver. Something that we're trying to be real careful about doing in our ministry is to explain that we are not oriented or set up for crisis counseling. We cannot be called all hours of the night and day. I teach too much, and therefore I'm gone a lot. I'm out of town, and we just don't have the money or just the setup to have people to answer the phone, all those kinds of things. And so I try to be real careful about that. If I have, when I have failed along the way, it's usually in promising something that I could not deliver, either because I was just too busy or could not remember it because so many things were going on or some reason like that. You can say to a person, you know, as you have agreed when we looked at the Scripture, you've not been a good husband. Your wife is angry, hurt, and probably bitter. She has reacted to your failures. I cannot guarantee that your wife will respond to your changing, but if I could, That would be a wrong motivation. You need to commit yourself to being a godly husband because it's well-pleasing to your Savior. That's letting the people know that you change not in order to get her or to change her, but you change because it's right to do it before the Lord, and you change out of love for Him. Love the Lord your God and love your neighbor as yourself, the two great commandments. So you don't want to give them guarantees. And again, I've heard people say, if you'll just do this, I guarantee you it'll all work out well. Don't do that. You don't know how they're going to respond. You don't know how they're hearing you. And frankly, you don't always know how God is working in a particular particular case. Now, you also need to have something together concerning disappointment resolution. If there's been a conflict, I like The Peacemaker by Ken Sandy as a good book to kind of order those things around. You might talk to people in conciliation ministries, conflict management. Just have something down and have something that you present to your counselee that says that if there is a problem, you'll let your churches deal with it. You won't be dragged into court. As just a 5-point disappointment resolution idea here from Dr. Eirich, 1, present your disappointment to your counselor. 2, ask the counselor to meet with you and the supervisor. 3, ask the counselor and supervisor to meet with you and your pastor or some ordained clergy of your choice. 4, present your disappointment to the appropriate governing board of the counseling center. And 5, seek outside arbitration with a group like Peacemakers International. The publication of such a policy provides an implied contract accepted by the counselee, which will postpone legal action sufficiently long enough to resolve problems without legal action. You may want to include a reference to this in your initial information or contract, which the counselee signs. It could read something like, if I am unhappy with my counselor or something my counselor says to me, I will gladly follow the center's resolution policy. Let me give you 4 principles to guide us concerning confidentiality as well. 1, confidentiality to the counselee is a general rule and is good. But 2, when crimes or potential crimes come to light, the counselee should be exhorted to become transparent and deal with the sin. 3, when exhortation fails, contacting the appropriate God-ordained authorities is essential. Now, sometimes when those crimes come to light, as we discussed earlier, you are bound by law to report them, and so you would do that at that point. 4, a promise or assumption of total confidentiality is inappropriate. When somebody comes in and says, and I've had this happen, they say, now everything I say is confidential, right? You can't tell anybody this. And I usually say, we hold to a general rule of confidentiality. However, there are some things, if you're going to harm somebody else or another, or if you already have harmed someone else, then, or intend to harm yourself, then I would have to report that. And that usually satisfies them. They usually just don't want some secret out that would not be a reporting offense. You know, in our day, we must keep open the idea that we may very well be sued. We have a very litigious society, and if we go into this business, we need to go in understanding that. That it may be part of the dedication and the commitment to the Lord, if indeed He is calling you to this kind of ministry, is that you go in willing to go through that if you have to on His behalf. But think through it very carefully and very clearly, so that you know what to expect. A good friend of mine years ago received a letter with a heading on the envelope, a return heading that was obviously from an attorney from a law firm, actually a law firm in New York, that he recognized as being a very big and prestigious law firm. And he went into his study without opening the letter, and he prayed. He just knew that this was the time that he was going to be sued. And he asked God to prepare him, to make him humble, and just to give him the courage to deal with it. Well, he opened the letter, and what he found inside was a check for $10,000 given through this law firm because the people wanted to remain anonymous. So that was a good surprise, as you can imagine, for his a ministry that certainly needed the money. But we may get that letter any day, any of us could, that is not so happy and is somebody taking advantage and trying to get something that they really are not due, but because of our society they may give it a try. And I just encourage you to, again, make plans to have your heart be settled that this is a ministry that you're called to, and then to press on with all due haste. So as we've looked at these things, I hope it's been an encouragement to you. I hope it encourages you to speak to a knowledgeable attorney. It's certainly worth $50 or $100 or $150 to sit down with somebody and be sure you understand what the laws are in your state concerning the kind of counseling that you'll be doing, given whatever your situation is, whether you're ordained or you're not, or you're working with a church or trying to go out on your own, whatever your state allows. It's good to get with an attorney and be certain. So I hope this is an encouragement to you. And as God calls us to courage, this is certainly an area in which we need to be called to courage. So take heart. The Lord will be with you wherever you go. If you're truly called of Him, He will walk before you, and He will make your path straight.